Welcome to Already Perfect, the Seattle Soto Zen podcast.
Good morning, everyone. Can you hear me okay? And you can even see me too. Thank you. So obviously, we're kind of helpless here at Seattle Soto Zen when Reverend Dr. Jundo Steve is ill and can't run our Sunday program. First of all, I lost the Zoom password, so I was late starting Zazen, and then I forgot the rope chant. And then during Kinhin, my cat jumped on my computer, and then my computer died. I don't think it was all my cat's fault, because my computer died, and when I tried to reboot it, it said it had to repair the BIOS. And that took about 15 minutes. And then somehow my internet browser had disappeared and I had to re-download it. So I'm not quite sure what's happening. Hopefully the gremlins have finished their mischief for today, at least on my computer. And yes, I did have you guys all muted, but I didn't realize that. That probably actually was my cat who probably hit the mute button. Yeah, there's for some reason my computer also has an airplane mode button on the keyboard, which I guess feels like a good idea if you don't have cats. But that has ended quite a few Zoom meetings for me. So thank you all for your patience with me. And I actually been thinking a lot about, a lot of people are sick all of a sudden, not just here at the Sangha, but at my work as well. And I guess it's not that strange now that people aren't wearing masks as much and they're going back to the office, that, all the regular bugs that we've had a little bit of a break from for the past couple of years while we've been trying to take better care have been, getting their opportunity. And then also some people in our community have more severe illnesses, which, also isn't terribly surprising, because that is a thing that happens, right? Especially as we get older. You think about how do we as a community care for each other? And I found a lovely sutra from the life of the Buddha. This is a great book that Norman recommended when I was studying for priest ordination. It's called The Life of the Buddha by Bhikkhu Nanamoli. And I'll put references to this talk up on the in the Discord. I know I promise to do that every week, and then I haven't done it for the last three Dharma talks, but I promise this time I will. So there's and Bhikkhu Nanamoli, he scoured the existing canon, that basically all the sutras from the Theravada and looked for ones that were about, you know, the life of the Buddha. So his story of the birth of the Buddha is very different from the one that we normally hear, because the one we normally hear has a lot of, you know, mythology built into it, and it's not really one of the early sutras. So he tried to piece together like a chronological biography of the Buddha from the Theravada sutras, which is a very interesting approach. So this is the story of the monk with dysentery. So dysentery is it's a tropical disease. It's an intestinal disease, quite dangerous and quite messy. So the story goes that there was a certain bhikshu, a monk in the community, was sick with dysentery, and he was laying in his hut. Because dysentery is an intestinal illness, he was really a mess. The other monks were away, and that they'd left this one monk alone. So as the Buddha was going around the hut with his attendant, the Venerable Ananda, he came to the dwelling of the sick monk. When he saw him lying fouled in his own urine and excrement, he went up to the sick monk and he said, "What is your sickness, Bhikshu?" And the monk replied, "It is dysentery, blessed one." "But Bhikshu, have you no attendant?" "No, blessed one." "Why do the other bhikshus not look after you, Bhikkhu?" "I am of no use to the bhikshus, my lord. That is why they do not look after me." Some translations say, "I am not kin to any of the bhikshus. That's why they don't. I'm not related to any of them." Which is, you know, similar, but puts a little bit of a different spin on the story. So, "I'm of no use to the other monks. That's why they don't look after me." Then the Blessed One said to the Venerable Ananda, "Ananda, go and fetch some water and let us wash this bhikshu." "Even so, Lord," Ananda replied, and he brought water. The Blessed One poured out the water and the Venerable Ananda washed the sick monk. Then the Blessed One took him by the head and Ananda took him by the feet, and they lift him up and they put him on a bed. "With this is the occasion and this is the reason," the Blessed One summoned the bhikshus and asked them. Now you kind of feel like he's sort of in dad mode here, right? He pulls them all together and he's like, "Bhikshus, is there a certain monk sick in a certain dwelling?" And the monk said, "Yes, there is, Blessed One." And you know, you could see he's kind of giving them a chance to own up that they made a mistake, but unfortunately, they're not going to get it in time. "So is there a monk sick in your community?" "Yes, there is, Blessed One." "And do you know the nature of this monk's illness?" "He has dysentery, Lord." "Is anyone looking after him?" "No, Lord." And you can see the Buddha's like, "Why do I even?" He says, "Why are the monks not looking after him?" "My Lord, that monk is of no use to the community. That is why we do not look after him." And then the Buddha's like, "Okay." "Monks, you have no mother or father to look after you. If you do not look after each other, who will look after you?" let him who would look after me, their teacher, look after one who is sick. If a sick monk has a preceptor, his preceptor should look after him as long as he lives until his recovery. His teacher, if he has one, should do otherwise. Or his roommate or his pupil, or one who has the same preceptor or one who has the same teacher. If he has none of those, the community in general should look after a sick monk. Not to do so is a serious offense. So this is how it is, right? So either this guy was, you know, chronically ill or just really quiet, didn't have a chance to make friends, or he was some stranger who didn't have any relatives there. And when he got sick, nobody felt moved to step forward and take responsibility. And the Buddha goes on to say, when a sick man has five qualities, he is hard to look after. If he does what is unsuitable, if he does not know the measure of what is suitable, he doesn't take his medicine, he doesn't disclose his illness to a sick nurse and tell him that it is better when he's feeling better, that it's worse when he's feeling worse, or the same when he feels the same, or he is unable to endure bodily feelings that are painful, disagreeable, and unwelcoming. When a sick man has the five opposite qualities, he's easy to look after. So if he doesn't do things to make himself worse, which, you know, I don't know, I do that. Even when I know better, when he doesn't even know how to keep himself from getting worse, and, you know, does the wrong thing out of ignorance, when he doesn't take his medicine, yeah, I've done that too, and when he doesn't tell the truth to the friends who look in on him, if he either says, no, I'm still too sick to get out of bed, when really, if he pushed himself, he probably could get out of bed. Or when he says, oh, no, don't worry about me, I'm fine, when he's not fine. And, you know, if he's not able to endure painful and disagreeable body sensations. And I mean, I don't think any of us really are, but I think we know that, you know, we can be more agreeable in some situations than we act. And then when a sick nurse has five qualities, he is he is unfit to look after the sick. When he is not clever at preparing medicine, when he does not know what is and what is not suitable, so he brings what is suitable and takes away what is suitable. He looks after the sick for mercenary reasons rather than with thoughts of loving kindness. He is squeamish around bodily fluids. He is not clever at instructing and encouraging the sick with timely talk of the Dharma. When a sick nurse has the five opposite qualities, he is fit to look after the sick. So I think there's a real lesson here in the story of the monk with dysentery. And I think it kind of fits into the whole theme of this year, the Dharma Talks for this year, which is on cultivating compassion. And I think sometimes people don't really understand cultivating compassion or compassion training, because compassion arises naturally, right? The story of the monk with dysentery kind of shows us the drawbacks to trusting that compassion will arise naturally in appropriate situations. So there was I didn't watch it closely, but I was aware of this whole very strange questioning of the new Supreme Court Justice Kentaji Brown. For some reason included them blowing up pages from a children's picture book, and then asking Judge Brown if she thought little babies were racist. And she said, I don't remember what she said, but it was something like, I'm a judge, not a librarian. Why are you asking me about children's picture books? But actually, probably, as far as we know, it probably little babies actually really are racist. And it's not their fault. When you're watching sports videos and one of the players is injured or is, you know, maybe kicked in a sensitive area, and you're watching it, and especially if you possess the sensitive areas where the guy was kicked, you kind of cringe a little bit when you see it. So they've done studies where they hook people up to these machines to test stress levels and show them these kinds of videos. And it turns out we react more strongly if the person on the screen getting injured has the same skin color we do. And again, it's not our fault. It's not a conscious decision. So, you know, that's obviously something that's good to know if we're thinking about compassion, you know, our natural impulse to compassion and its limitations. They also did another study of college students, which are, you know, obviously what all good psychological studies use as test subjects, where they had somebody pretend to be badly injured and timed how long it took someone to check up on the injured person. And so they had three conditions. The one was he was dressed in neutral clothing. The second was he was wearing a football jersey of the school. And the third was he was wearing a football jersey of a rival school. It took a lot longer for people to check in on him if he was wearing the football jersey of a rival school. Which, you know, if somebody has fainted or broken their leg, it shouldn't really matter what shirt he's wearing, should it? But it does, right? And again, it's not our fault. And we don't do it on purpose. But, you know, aside from all the microplastics in our bloodstreams, our bodies aren't really fundamentally different than our Stone Age ancestors. And neither are our brains. So we evolved in circumstances where we probably interacted with a maximum of 100 people on a day-to-day basis. And they probably, you know, if if we were safe with them, we were probably with people who looked like us and talked like us. And if we weren't surrounded by people who looked like us and talked like us, there was probably something wrong. Either we were lost or they were lost, or we were fighting. So, you know, it's not really strange that her compassion has these limitations built in. But it's also not something that we can't work on, which is why we talk about compassion training. The Joan Halifax talks about, you know, the three kinds of compassion. This is in her book, Standing on the Edge. And the first is referential compassion, which is the kind that arises spontaneously. She said, most of us experience compassion towards those with whom we share close connections. We may feel a stronger connection with those who have suffered in ways that we ourselves have suffered. Because I was blind as a child, I have long noticed that I feel a vivid identification with and compassion for blind people. Referential compassion may also extend beyond the circle of our families, of our familiars, to include those who we don't know, such as victims of sexual harassment or police violence, or the unsheltered and refugees. It can also extend to creatures and places. This kind of compassion is embodied in the story of the women from La Patrona, a small village not far from the city of Veracruz. One day, more than 20 years ago, two sisters, Bernarda and Rosa Romero Vasquez, were returning from purchasing milk and bread for breakfast. They stood at a train crossing while a freight train approached. They were surprised to see train hoppers clinging to the tops and sides of the boxcars and young people riding the rods beneath. A man hanging on to one of those first boxcars called to them, "Madre, we are hungry." As car after car passed, more shouts filled their ears, "Madre, we are hungry." Before the last train car, Bernarda and Rosa tossed their newly purchased food to those who could catch it. When Bernarda and Rosa returned to their family home that morning, they were afraid they would be punished for giving away their family's breakfast. But instead of punishing their sisters, the family gathered together to see that what could be done, and a plan emerged. Since 1995, when sisters tossed the first food to transiting migrants, nearly every day these sisters and other villagers of La Patrona have stood behind the railroad tracks with food for those riding the rails to hope for freedom. La Bestia is a moniker for the trains that have carried thousands north through Mexico to the U.S. border. When La Bestia passed on its route to Veracruz and near La Patrona, the village women, or as they are called, Las Patronas, dashed to the railroad tracks with bulging plastic bags of freshly cooked beans, rice, and tortillas. As the train hurtles by, they toss their offerings to the hungry migrant train hoppers. I was told that sometimes the train slows at night, so Las Patronas can more easily give away their food bags. Hearing about Las Patronas from my Mexican friends in Santa Fe and following their miraculous and humble work through media reports, I am moved by the great compassion and bold determination of these women, who show up day after day cooking and delivering beans, rice, and tortillas for those traveling north. They represent to me the best in the human heart: compassion, altruism, grit, dedication, and engagement, and the power to transform suffering against all odds. Referential compassion is deeply valued in this and our society, and that is a good thing. Yet there are forms of compassion that are less familiar to most of us. One of them is insight-based compassion, a concept that also exists within Tibetan Buddhism. This type of compassion is more conceptual. It focuses on impermanence and dependent co-arising. When we see someone in need, ideally, we feel morally compelled to act. We don't feel indifference or moral apathy. Responding to suffering with compassion is the right thing to do, an affirmation of respect and human dignity. When we experience the suffering of others from this perspective, and when this understanding is supported by our natural kindness and our aspiration to relieve suffering, then our heart will be filled with wise compassion. This is something that always surprised me about the Dalai Lama. Whenever when he's asked about compassion practices, he usually responds that, you know, well, it's just logical. Which is, you know, not what I expected. You know, I expected him to talk about, you know, warm feelings. But he tends to speak more about how, well, it just makes sense. You know, well, I practice compassion because I feel good and the person I'm helping feels good. Why would I do something else? Not so long ago, I was sitting at the bedside of a woman who was dying of liver cancer. This was the day before she would take her last breath, although I didn't know it at the time. She had been a close friend and had fought cancer for years. I experienced great compassion for her. Referential compassion as she was being tossed about by confusion and pain. I felt the overwhelming wish to relieve her suffering. At the same time, through the lens of insight-based compassion, I was able to see her situation in terms of the truth of impermanence, that her suffering was a discrete moment in time and was made up of non-suffering elements. I also felt deep in my heart that responding to her suffering was a moral necessity. These perspectives kept me from succumbing to empathic distress and helped me hold the space for her in a less reactive way and to be with her with greater love. I think that's kind of maybe a drawback. To our culture is that we seem to believe there's this split between the thinking mind and the feeling mind. And Norman talks about this in his book, Training and Compassion, that, you know, we have an idea that intellectual people are, you know, either arrogant or absent-minded. And compassionate people are, you know, sort of fuzzy-headed and not very logical. Whereas the Buddhist teaching is that wisdom and compassion must always be cultivated together, so that to be truly wise, we must also be compassionate. And to be effectively compassionate, we also must be wise. Not necessarily smart, but wise, like the Buddha said, to know what is suitable and what is unsuitable, so that we don't bring a sick person something that will make them worse and take away the medicine that will make them better, which I'm sure we've all done at some point, unfortunately. So they say wisdom and compassion are like two wings of a bird. So if you only exercise one wing, you're not going to fly very far. So, you know, it's okay if compassion doesn't, you know, if I don't really feel this, immediate sense of my heart reaching out to somebody, because, you know, the insight base, the more intellectual process brings me there as well. And there's a third form of compassion, which is unbiased. We can call this non-referential compassion, which is true compassion. And Roshi Dhyan Halifax goes on to say, I experienced this myself once. I was teaching in Toronto and staying in a private home. Getting out of the shower, I slipped on the wet floor and fell, shattering my thigh bone. I immediately knew a very bad thing had happened to me when I looked at the angle of my leg. A few heartbeats later, I was seized in the grip of excruciating pain. Being a good Southerner, I politely called out, "Can someone help me?" My voice was thin and I could barely breathe. Within minutes, my host Andrew arrived and gently braced my back where I was sitting on the floor and shouted to his wife to call an ambulance. When the first responders arrived, a young medic came into the bathroom and announced that they were going to move me onto a gurney. I was already on the edge of blacking out from pain, and I could feel my blood pressure dropping from the intensity. I looked the young medic straight in the eyes and said, "Before you move me, I need something for the pain." The medic told me in a flat voice that he was not licensed to administer morphine. "Get me someone who is," I said. I wasn't kidding. He dialed his phone to bring in a licensed provider. 10 long minutes later, an older medic arrived. He knelt beside me and took my blood pressure, which was ocean bottom low. He nodded and with a syringe pulled clear liquid from a small bottle. He stretched out my arm, but my veins had collapsed from shock and the needle poke yielded nothing. He tried the other arm and then I don't remember where. I only recalled noticing the sweat drip down his face as he tried to help me. The young medic was standing beside the bathroom wall looking pale. His eyes rolled up as though he was going to faint. He seemed distressed watching me get stuck by the needle multiple times. My heart opened to him, and at that moment, my veins opened too, flushing my body with blood. The needle slipped in, and I felt enough relief that I could be moved. Finally, I was in the ambulance, and we were racing through Toronto Street toward the hospital, sirens screaming. It was Friday the 13th and a full moon in June. The older medic leaned close to me and I sensed that something was weighing him down. Without thinking, I touched his knee and asked if he was all right. It was a strange question for me to be asking under the circumstances, but it arose out of nowhere. The kind of nowhere that is there during deep meditation. The nowhere that is present when pain has eclipsed itself. The medic's eyes were wet, and he said in a barely audible voice, "My wife is dying of breast cancer." In that moment, nothing existed but this suffering human beside me and the inexplicable warmth I felt in my body, in my heart, and in the atmosphere between us. In that moment, my pain vanished completely. I looked into his eyes, and they were wet and unguarded. In retrospect, I realized that in the midst of my own critical state, I had opened into an experience of universal compassion. The experience was not about him and not about me. The upwelling of boundless concern and love for another had dissolved my sense of self, and with that, my pain had melted away. During a recent visit with my old friend Ram Dass, we were talking about compassion. He reminded me of these words from the Ramayana. Ram, who is God, asked Hanuman, the monkey god, who embodies selfless service, "Who are you, monkey?" Hanuman replies, "When I don't know who I am, I serve you. When I do know who I am you." My old friend and I smiled at each other. Is this not the deepest expression of compassion? Who are you, monkey? When I don't know who I am, I serve you. When I know who I am you. I think this was, you know, as well as being practical advice, I think this was what the Buddha was trying to get through to his monks. You know, that compassion is, it's not dependent on if you know someone or if they've helped you already and you owe them something. Because they're in front of me and they're suffering, I help them. Whether it's because of existing in some deep meditative state where I'm in tune with the universal life that we all share, which I believe the Buddha was. I think that's what made him the Buddha. Or because I know it's the right thing to do, or because my heart is moved and I see myself and that poor sick person, or for any other reason. The last thing I want to share is a short message from Reverend Eason Dorsey, who was a Zen priest who studied with Suzuki Roshi. And he also set up one of the first hospices for AIDS patients in San Francisco. He says, "We have to be willing to explore and experiment in our practice. To do this, we have to have a sense of humor and a willingness to experiment with our lives and our uncomfortableness. For instance, we know that sometimes we can sit for a few minutes and at some point it gets pretty uncomfortable. Lately, I have been exploring this way of thinking with a friend who has AIDS dementia. The virus is living in his brain. I'm thinking and working on it and talking with him about it because the virus that is attacking so many of us is now living in his brain. So is there some way for us who aren't sick to experience that with him? How can we be with people who have dementia? And how can we experience the delusion that we all have anyway? Mind is always creating confusion, joy, depression, like and don't like. But there is also a background mind. This background mind is what my friend and I have been discussing. Sometimes when I'm talking about uncomfortableness, I talk about the five fears: fear of dying, fear of illness, fear of dementia, the fear of loss of livelihood, and the fear of public speaking. Especially the third one, the fear of unusual states of mind. How can we come to have appreciation and respect for this fear and not just resistance, so that we can enter our fear, allowing these new areas of uncomfortableness? Why do we have to sit? Really, if we're completely sincere, then there's no reason to sit. I am not completely sincere. so I have to keep sitting to check on myself. Even if we're involved with unskillful actions, the one quality we should strive for is truthfulness. Then, if we can embrace the totality of ourselves, we can embrace the totality of others and of the world. Even when we see a beautiful flower, we say, oh, what a beautiful flower. Beautiful flower is extra. Just look at the flower. Even Zazen practice gets so complicated. We're dissecting every aspect of what's going on, reviewing and comparing. How can we keep it simple and straightforward? The teaching and the rules can and should change according to the situation and the people we're practicing with. But the secret of practice cannot be changed. It's always truth. The practice is simple. Watch your breath and don't invite your thoughts to tea. But not inviting your thoughts to tea doesn't mean get rid of thinking. There's no reason to get rid of thoughts, but to have a non-interfering relationship with them. Begin to see the space behind and around the thoughts. Shift the seat of your identity out of your thoughts and come to reside in your breath mind. We develop our intention to reside in our breath mind by first bringing our intention to breath as mind, and then by shifting the seat of our identity from our thoughts to our breath. This all ties in with how we use the meditation hall, this laboratory. We should have a willingness to explore with our lives, and this is our laboratory right here, how we use the meditation hall and how we use what happens outside of it. Mindfulness is not a part-time job. Mindfulness is not a part-time job. Please, everyone, especially those of you who are sick and those of you who are caring for the sick right now, please take very good care of yourselves. I love you very much. And I needed a push to get me to see. Wherever I am, I'm already free.
Thank you for listening. Please find us at seattlesotozen.org. Our theme music is by Stuart Davis. Gosh, show. Sure.